This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Korerotia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Korerotia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
Ko Speak Up kōrero tia tēnei, ko sale kalta nā hau te rangatia o te hōtaka. Today we're talking about pets and intimate partner violence. I'd been looking to do a show on family violence given that White Ribbon Day is coming up on the 25th of November, and this specific topic was suggested to me as one that would be quite important to explore. And the more I looked into it as I was doing some research for the show, the more I realised that the linkages between pets and animals more broadly, maybe farm animals, for example, and family violence are really significant, not least because the fear of the safety for their animals can be a major influencer in victims' decisions to remain in a violent relationship. To talk us through more detail about the situation, we're really lucky to have three very expert guests today. We've got Gwenda Kendrew from Aviva Families, we've got Nick Taylor from the University of Canterbury, and Julie Chapman from Pet Refuge. Julie, perhaps we'll start with you. If you could tell us a little bit about yourself, and you've been on the show before talking about period poverty, and now here you are wearing a very different hat.
Yes, from period poverty to pets. Yeah, so I am the founder of Pet Refuge, an organisation which has been started in the last few years, really with a focus on removing just one of the barriers that women and children face when wanting to leave family harm situations. I became aware that pets were being used as a means of control. They were often injured themselves, abused, killed, particularly in front of children. And that was a barrier for people wanting to leave because they didn't want to leave their pets behind. They knew that if they did, they would possibly be killed or severely injured. So the idea for Pet Refuge came out of that. I've always wanted to do something for animals and became able to do that due to the unfortunate passing of my parents. And so got some land, and we're about 3/4 of the way through the build of Pet Refuge now, which will provide temporary housing of pets for those escaping violence for as long as they're needed and free of charge while they secure their own safety. And then ultimately the goal is to reunite those pets with their families.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. Perhaps Nick, we could hear about you and some of the research that you've done.
I'm at the University of Canterbury. I'm in the Human Services Department. My research really is human relationships with other animals, and it's fairly broad. I cover an awful lot of work that centres on animal abuse, and that's the link through to domestic violence and companion animal abuse. And I guess what I'm really interested in is, generally speaking, the way that power and control manifest themselves in our society. And obviously, they manifest themselves really clearly in our relationships with other animals because we consider ourselves superior to them. And again, you can start to see the pathway there in terms of that interest in power and control and coercion in terms of how animals are then used in families where domestic violence is occurring. They become very much a coercive device that are used by the perpetrators. Probably for about the last 20 years, I've been researching this link between animal abuse and human abuse, with a focus on domestic violence, child abuse and animal abuse. And I'm actually moving now into, rather than research that aims to reiterate the connection, because I think that research is out there, I'm becoming more interested in how do we address it? How do we start to resolve these problems through things like Pet Refuge and through things like service provision?
Thank you very much for that. And Gwenda, as our final guest.
Good morning. My role here today, I guess, is to speak on behalf of those who we are working with and my team at Aviva. We are fortunate to be able to journey alongside those who are experiencing family violence. I say fortunate because it allows us to hear stories and bring people to hopefully a place of reconciliation. But what we've learnt is two things. Pets are very much a part of family these days, probably have been for a long time. And so when we're faced with working with someone who's going through a domestic violence situation, there is often a pet involved. And for the family, it's part of their family, and so we need to treat that as such. I've been fortunate over my time to share some of the stories, and I brought a few of them with me today in case there's opportunity to share around how we've worked alongside places like Pet Refuge or the SPCA locally in supporting families through that time when the decision around do I stay because of my pet or do I go if there's somewhere safe for my pet has been a real conversation. And so to be part of this today is really exciting, to think that there's things that are going to be changed maybe or improved for those in this situation. Part of my personal journey, I've also worked with those who have used violence, both against other people but also against animals. And so to be able to hear some of their story and then bring it into the work that I do now gives me a little bit of understanding around the why and how long this concern has been around for. So really excited to hear from the others around what's happening out there and what they're finding.
Thank you. Well, just to kickstart the conversation then, we're coming from a premise here that there is a linkage between violence to animals and violence to people. Nick, you might be a good person to start us off this conversation around this idea of violence against animals almost being a predictor of violence that may well come down the line. And just sort of introducing us to this concept would be really great.
It's fairly complex. I think the first thing to say is that mainstream media portrayals of this are perhaps a bit too simplistic. It isn't a case of children who are cruel to animals will grow up to be serial killers, although we do know that a lot of serial killers did start by being cruel to animals. What research is showing, and this is global research, it's not just in Aotearoa, it's around the world, it's showing us that there's a correlation here. And this correlation is quite muddy in some ways. So, for example, we know that children who are cruel to animals may be in violent situations themselves, and they're using that cruelty as a cry for help. We know that children who are cruel to animals may go on to be violent towards humans, and certainly may go on to continue to be violent towards animals. We know that in situations of domestic violence, that those who harm animals physically and emotionally are the ones who are most likely to be most violent towards humans. But this link is particularly there with emotional violence towards animals, which speaks, I think, to the coercion aspect. And so, you know, we've got this whole body of research that says it's not a case of A leads to B, but it's definitely a case of if there is violence happening to animals by a human, then there's something else going on, something else that's worthy of further investigation, whether that's children being cruel to animals outside of the family or whether it's occurring within the family.
If we're talking about family violence, the extent of the problem here in Aotearoa,
we have the worst stat in the world, nothing to be proud of when we talk about that. And when we meet with families and begin to unpack what's happening for them, not always do we hear about the animal in the family. Not often do we hear about the connection there until we've spent some time with a family or even walked into a home and found that there's a pet involved in the situation. Sometimes what's going on for the people, if they're not at the point of leaving or even considering leaving, they haven't considered the part the pet may play in this, unless the animal is being abused already. And then there'll be a concern sometimes more about the animal and removing the animal than actually removing themselves.
We worked with Women's Refuge in 2018 to look at this particular issue. I mean, there was some research done in 2012, which really revealed the extent of, I guess, pets as pawns in family violence situations. But we felt that it was important to sort of update that research so we could get a really good handle on the sort of current need. So we did that, and we had more than 900 women answer the research questions or survey. And you know, there were some really revealing statistics that came out of that. 22% of the children of those women had witnessed violence and abuse towards a pet, and even been made to participate in it. 23% had had a pet actually killed by their partner. So that was a very traumatic experience and a significant loss for them. And 53% said that they had delayed leaving a situation where violence was occurring because of their pet. And then interestingly, I think around 78% of them said that that would have made it easier for them to leave if they knew there was somewhere their pet could be housed, looked after, kept in contact with them by various means, and ultimately knowing that, you know, that pet was safe while they were in a safe house or in other places where they perhaps couldn't have that pet.
I think one thing to point out here as well is that New Zealand has a very, very high rate of pet ownership globally.
Huge, yeah. I think, is it like 60-something percent of all New Zealand households either have a cat or a dog? And the interesting part of the research was that, like, if you look at the abuse of animals, dogs were the most abused animal, followed by cats. And then the third most abused animal were actually farm animals, so particularly cows and horses. So it really did show a prevalence of abuse against larger animals, or herd animals as well.
One of the stories that we heard, and I think about what you've just said, was around a family who were rural living, and the income came from the keeping of dairy cows, and the conversation happened in that home that there was the threat of, if you leave, then I'll kill the animals and you will have no ongoing income, or if you start talking and planning about it, I'll do that and you'll still have no income or potential risk. And of course, for people who are facing domestic violence and leaving, all of these things become really important around how am I going to survive if I leave, and if I cause animals to be harmed in the process, what part am I playing in that? So much confusion for people around the decision that they make. It just becomes something that they wouldn't have thought about, but the connection there, the financial control that happens through that kind of statement, is not unusual.
And it's that continued manipulation, isn't it? And playing into those fears. And, you know, who would want to be responsible for animals or being made to feel responsible for the death of a whole lot of animals? It's just, it's a horrific position to be put in.
I think that guilt's worse as well when there's children present. We heard in our research from women who talked about not only the guilt that they felt in terms of leaving their animals behind, but the guilt that they felt in separating their children from animals that they knew that they loved, and particularly separating their children from animals at a time when they felt that the animal offered an awful lot of emotional support to the children. So it compounds. It gets increasingly more complicated when animals and our relationships with animals are factored into this.
Yes, absolutely. Yep, definitely.
We might have our first song break now, Lean On Me, which was Julie's choice. Julie, maybe if you'd like to talk us through that a bit more.
The song Lean On Me, we managed to get the license to use that song for the launch of the Pet Refuge publicly. And we felt the lyrics really spoke to the comfort that pets and people actually give each other. You know, pets are part of the family, especially for children who are experiencing traumatic circumstances, pets become really important. So it was sort of used as a we can lean on each other sort of scenario with the song, and it really worked well for our campaign. And of course, you know, it's a beautiful song anyway. I think most people would recognise it and love it.
Thank you. is tomorrow. Lean on me when you're not strong, and I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on, for it won't be long till I'm gonna need somebody to lean on. Please swallow your pride if I
thinking about violence towards animals, what kind of a violence or abuse are we talking about here? If we could maybe start to think about some of the examples in the cases.
I can give a couple of examples that have certainly stuck out for me reading the research. They're pretty graphic. I mean, when I first read the research in 2019, when it came out from Women's Refuge, I had to sort of put it down and walk away and come back to it because it was so shocking, some of the things. One that really stuck out to me was a woman who separated from her partner, and she'd bought her son a puppy. And one day the partner and his mate decided to come round to the house and hold a mock court around whether the son should be allowed to keep the puppy. Of course, they decided that he shouldn't be allowed to keep the puppy, so they took the puppy outside and shot it in front of the child. So for me, that was, I almost couldn't believe it. I know it's true and I know it happens, but you just kind of wonder about the level of, I don't know, evilness that some people have, that they would do that. Then there were others where pets would be burnt with cigarettes, ears cut off, kicked. Yeah, just, you know, really horrific sorts of stuff. And then the sort of other general stuff, which is still just as bad, where they would control the woman by not allowing her to seek medical or vet treatment for a pet, not allowing them to feed their pet or let the pet inside. So those kind of psychological type things that would go on that would, you know, cause huge amounts of guilt and trauma as well, just as much as the physical violence. So yeah, it was pretty shocking.
Sometimes there can be an emotional play as well. We've had stories where people have considered leaving and maybe have left the home for a couple of days and come home to find that the pet's no longer there. And for a child who's involved in that, they've come home expecting to find the pet, expecting for life to be reunited and continued on. And in some occasions, we've never found out what's happened to those animals. That in itself continues to play on the mind of those that have experienced the violence, whether it's the adult or the child. We continue to hear stories of harmed animals, and it may not be, and I don't mean to minimise this, significant harm, but enough harm for a child or someone considering to leave to know there's a threat there and what else could happen. So again, that whole control is something that can be ongoing for quite a long time and plays quite a large part in whether people choose to actually be able to walk away.
Part of it that we found in the research was they would do something to the pet, basically to show that if I can do this to the pet, you know, I say, I'll do this to you. This is what will happen. And I mean, there were much more graphic stories that came out, which I just can't even repeat because some of them are so awful. It's horrific, and it really does play into that control and manipulation of getting the person to do what you want. Otherwise, the pet will get it, or you'll get it.
Animals are also subject to emotional abuse. And it's part of the research that's really undercooked. We know hardly anything about the emotional abuse of animals, largely because for a long time we've denied the fact that animals have emotions. But what we do know from the small bits of research that we've got from around the world is that animals' response to emotional abuse is much the same as ours. So they can suffer trauma and PTSD. They can become hypervigilant. They can become really anxious. They can become aggressive. And this can happen in households where there's no physical violence at all. It's all emotional. It's all at the level of coercion. And it can also happen when it's not directed specifically at the animals, but the animals are picking up on what's happening between the humans. So I think the scope there certainly for an awful lot more recognition, a lot more training, a lot more research around the impacts that this has on the animal themselves in the family, as well as the impacts on the humans.
Does that make it harder in the long run, for example, to rehome pets that have been taken out of these sorts of situations if, for example, there's increased anxiety, increased aggression, those sorts of things, if the family is not able to keep the pet themselves?
Yes, very much so. Again, we're seeing from the small pieces of research that we do have that increasingly these animals will end up in SPCA shelters. If they can't be reunited with their human, they'll be euthanized because of so-called behavioral problems. And I think this actually is one of the avenues for training. I think when we start talking about the training that we're going to offer to those in human services and animal welfare services, I think awareness of the way that this kind of trauma plays out in behavior and subsequently how it can be addressed is really important, because I think a lot of these animals lose out. So for instance, there was some research done in Australia where a lot of these animals, these were dogs in particular, they were terrified of men, and they just could not interact with men. And in fact, I've lived with a dog who was a victim of domestic violence, and she had experienced it for about 6 months before she came to me, which isn't a great deal of time in her life. She was 6 months when I got her. She lived to be 17. For those 16 and a half years, she hated men. She wouldn't go anywhere near them. She was terrified of them. She would scream at them. It was beyond barking. She would scream in terror at them if she saw them on the streets. And this took years to get her to the point where I could actually walk her down the road. And most people are not in the position to offer that kind of care for animals. So, of course, it makes their chances of being rehomed incredibly narrow.
We've spoken a bit about how pets can be used as a tool of coercion and control, and the fear that people have, that something will happen to their pets or to them, the guilt they may feel for leaving the pet behind. Are there any other impacts, either short or long term, that you're seeing among people who have left these sorts of situations?
I think some of the stories that we've heard of people who no longer have been able to keep their pet for whatever reason, whether the pet has died or whether the pet's ended up somewhere else, they're a little loath to have another pet in their home, especially if there's children, because if the children have gone through some trauma around losing a pet, to do that again, sometimes people would feel guilty about bringing that possibility. Often for children, what we hearing is they want another, because for them it's something to love, something that responds back to them, and the healing that could happen from having a pet in those occasions would be tremendous. But it's not something that the adult has taken on board easily, because they realise there's more risk if the abuser hasn't totally gone from their lives, and the story about them returning to a home that just sits there. And so a decision around having another animal and what that might mean can cause some concern and friction within the family, conflict within the family. It's bad enough for those that aren't experiencing family violence when a child wants a pet and the stories that you might need to put there. But when it's been this kind of experience, it just adds some complexity.
You know, one of the things that we think will be an area that we need to explore more and work on relationships in is the ability for people who are going into new housing to actually have pets, because there are a lot of landlords that, for whatever reason, just don't want a cat or a dog in their house, so it's quite hard to get accommodation that allows pets. I think Kāinga Ora now has a policy where they will allow a cat or a dog. But I guess sometimes in those situations too, whilst they might say you can have a cat or a dog, the place might not be secure, it might not have fencing. So we see our role at Pet Refuge as really helping as much as we can to facilitate them being reunited. And if that means that we need to form a relationship with Kāinga Ora and we need to build a fence or some way of containing a dog, then my view is we'll do that, because that relationship is so important for children and the families.
One of the other concerns that families have been faced with is sometimes the cost of what's happened to an animal when there's been family violence involved as well. We had a situation where an animal had been harmed and it remained with the mum and the children. They then had to face the cost of the vet bills, and ultimately for their animal it needed to be put down. All of that was just something that compounded all the emotions and feelings and the situation in itself. None of us expected that with that situation. We didn't quite think that through as we were working with them. But again, the staff, I have to say, at the vet clinic were incredibly supportive, but there was nothing that they could do, and there was a cost involved. However, we found some funding for that, but it's not on the radar when people are thinking about leaving, and if there's an animal involved, what might happen and what does happen. It just keeps going for people. And so again, having the ability within a law change to claim that is something that's totally inappropriate, and how the abuser of the animal needs to respond, what their responsibility is in that as well.
Pets provide such a source of comfort and solace and fun and all those sort of positive things. Longer term, have you seen any impacts on the children?
We run domestic violence educational programs with children and adults, and one of the sessions, particularly for the children, we've had the SPCA come in and bring some animals and talk about care and protection of an animal, but also realise how a child may feel. We've had occasions when people who are facing family violence, families that are living with a pet and an animal arrives with the SPCA, we've watched children remove themselves from that circle, and it's offered us opportunity to again have conversations around why they're not able to connect to the animal and what they might have seen in the past. But for others, it's an attempt at breaking the cycle. For as much as we do that with adults around attempting to break the cycle around abusing each other, we've found that the correlation between abuse to animals, as we've talked about today, and potentially abusing others, if we can have that conversation with a child, we would hope that there's potential in the future that that situation, either to an animal or to another human, isn't going to happen.
I was involved in some research, really reiterates that point. It was an animal-assisted therapy project, and it was with young children under the age of 12 who had been sexually abused. It was a fairly short project, but the children interacted with dogs, the supervision of social workers and SPCA to make sure that the dogs were safe, because a lot of these children had been acting out with violence towards animals. The various measures that we ran past them, we found that their PTSD symptoms really dropped as a result of the animal-assisted therapy. We found that they were happier, more open, more willing to talk about their feelings. And we also found from the social workers that they were able to strike up better relationships with these kids so that they felt that they could achieve more with them. It was back in Australia, but what was really interesting was it seemed to work incredibly well for Indigenous boys, which can be a group that are quite difficult to work with in terms of building those bridges. They don't necessarily want to talk about their feelings. And we found that it worked really well for them. So I think on the other side of this, there is this aspect where animals are emotionally safe for children who have become very closed and buttoned down because of the trauma that they have experienced. And animals can help address that, can help open them up again, can help them relearn empathy for other living beings, which may get into the aspects of breaking the cycle. The one thing I will say is that unfortunately, I think a lot of places have seen animal-assisted therapy as a quick cure-all, and it really isn't. It's long-term investment. It takes a lot to do it properly. And animal welfare's got to be at the centre of this, because we're dealing with clients who more often than not have been cruel to animals, so we've got to make sure there's a lot of safety for the animals involved before we set any therapies up.
We might have our second song then, and then we'll get back and talk a bit more about some of the barriers that prevent victims leaving the relationship. We've already touched on a few, and also ways in which we can look to try and break some of those barriers down.
It's him or me, that's what he said. But I can't choose between a vegan and a pothead, so I chose you because you're sweet and you give me lots of loving and you eat meat, and that's how you became my only man of the air. You never lie, and you don't cheat, and you don't have any baggage tied to your 4 feet. Do I deserve to be the one who will feed you breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and take you to the park at dawn? Will you really be my only man of the hour? I know you'll never bring me flowers, but flowers, well, they will only die. And though we'll never take a shower together, I know you never argue, you don't even talk, and I like the way you let me lead you when we go outside and walk. Will you really be my only man of the hour? My only man of the hour. lonely man of the hour.
This is Speak Up Cordero here, and today we're talking about pets and family violence with Nick Taylor, Wenda Kendrew, and Julie Chapman. Just to finish off, we'd like to think about some of the barriers that are in place that prevent or make it harder for victims of family violence, intimate partner violence, to leave a relationship if they have pets. We've already talked about the fact that some landlords don't allow pets. We've already talked about the fact that not many refuges enable people to bring their pets with them. There are also some of the costs involved that we've talked about, but any of those other barriers that we haven't yet talked about would be great.
I think, you know, one of them that you sort of just touched on is it is often financial, because obviously a lot of catteries and kennels and places that can take pets. But of course, part of domestic violence is the financial abuse aspect of that. So that is one of the reasons that Pet Refuge will provide a free service, because we know that at the time of leaving, and certainly for some time afterwards, there's, you know, limited financial resources. Our goal and our aim was always to provide a free service. And then once pets are reunited, actually provide a, want of a better word, a welcome home pack that contains some products and flea treatments and worming and all of those things that a pet might need for 3 or 4 months down the track, just to ease that financial burden as well.
Julie, I'm just thinking that that's so exciting to think that you would do that. Can I encourage you, from an administration point of view, keep those statistics and push hard for funding? If we're trying to change how society look at the involvement of pets has a part to play in family violence, then we've managed to get some support over the years for a quicker response around supporting people who are going through a domestic violence situation. It'd be great to know that the pets were part of that story, and I guess your data, because I think you'll find the need will be great. And so to be able to respond to that in time means there's hope that some more support could come.
I think there's also a need for more training, more awareness. So I think one of the issues is that animal abuse is just not considered to be that important in the grander scheme of things. And so things like police responses or legal responses can often be lacking. There's some great initiatives coming out of the states where magistrates have been subject to training about the importance of this, and their responses have started to change. So I think that, there's a lot of, I like your use of the word hope there, Gwenda. You know, I think there's a lot of doom and gloom here, because we're not dealing with easy issues, but I also think there's hope. I think we're starting to see some changes, and the more that we get the message out there that abuse of animals matters, and that abuse of animals in domestic violence context matters, even if you don't like animals, it matters because it lets you help humans more, then I think there's hope ahead for change.
Police don't do it now unless they sort of write it down in the summary of facts, but I think it's on the poll 400 or the form that they use. There's no recording of whether there's pets present or whether violence has been committed against the pets. And I feel like that would be a pretty easy change to make, to sort of record those statistics. And also in the states, you know, I think in some states they include pets in protection orders, whereas here at the moment pets are considered property. So I would love to see pets covered by protection orders as well, to extend that out.
I did see somewhere as I was doing some research for this show that in some cases perpetrators are committing violence against animals because that's less likely to be followed up by the police. And so the end goal is the same, in that they're still managing to control their victims, but it's not got the same level of scrutiny.
This is not an easy topic to talk across the table at dinner, but one of the things we're working really hard on around family violence is encouraging society to talk about it. It's not right. It's not appropriate. It's not good in any sense. And to open up opportunities to be able to speak it out may cause people to think about their initial response. We had a situation where a family were wanting to leave the home. They'd packed a very small bag and they had ordered an Uber. And the Uber driver was amazing. They had the dog. It was, you know, the pocket dog. And it was easy to be carried, but kind of did a wee argue at the initial getting in of the car, and the woman just made some very quick comment about what was going on. He didn't say one more word. He packed them in the car and they were gone and got down the road. And he said later, we don't normally take animals, but I need to do something with you all. And off they went, and a response was made. But again, if that person had said no, then I'm not sure what would have happened at the door of that house, whether the animal would have been left or whether they all would have stayed. Again, someone just made a decision, took action. We all need to get the word out that violence of any kind is not appropriate, and what part we each play when we've got an opportunity to respond can bring a change to society. So encouraging people to think and respond as they would want response, I guess, for themselves if it was happening for them.
We do need to get those messages out there, but certainly I noticed that when I first started talking about pets as part of family violence, there was a real look of surprise on people's faces, or most people, because they just didn't register that a pet could be used as part of a means of coercion or control. So it is an education kind of thing, and making sure that we get those messages out there so that people have a deeper understanding.
I think the animals themselves can be useful there. I was involved in a project in South Australia where it was two-pronged. We did interviews with women who had been in violent situations with their animals, but we also, with the service there, the Northern Domestic Violence Service, put on an art exhibition. And with the art exhibition, we got volunteers from the local photography club to take pictures of the women, the kids, and their animals. These were safe pictures with de-identified humans. The art exhibition was of their animals and of their relationships with their animals. And then this art exhibition was shown in various places around the county. And what we found was that people were drawn to these images of the animals. They were positive images. They were happy images. And then in looking at those images and then talking to the volunteers who were stood there while people were browsing, they were then open to the idea of talking about domestic violence in a way that I've found to be quite different. Most people shut down, they don't want to hear. But the images of these animals drew them in. So I do think that animals are our friends in this. I'm not saying that we use the animals, but I think we include the animals, because I think those kind of images pull down a lot of barriers and get people talking in ways that are really unusual.
Absolutely.
We've sort of touched on as well the idea of providing some training to staff, not only of groups who support the victims, but also groups who support the animals. So that might be vets, that might be the SPCA, those sorts of groups. Have you got any particularly concrete changes you'd like to see coming out of that, or actions that you think they should be taking? How would you go about doing the training, I suppose?
I would like to see some more in-depth training around, I know there's a lot of it in parts of Australia where vets have, as part of their training, really being able to identify and pick up signs of non-accidental injury. I'm not sure how much of that is covered in the course or the teachings here, but I'd love to see more of that, because often one of the ways that it can be spotted is if an animal goes to the vet and there is a non-accidental injury, but it's how you spot that, and you do need the training to be able to do that.
I think getting this information into undergraduate curriculums would be a good start too, and that could be in the veterinary field, but it could also be in social work and human services. I think it needs to be, you know, a mandatory part of training at that undergraduate level, so that we're sending out more human and animal welfare workers into the world equipped with this knowledge. And I also think we need to make space for animal recovery. I mean, this all comes down to costs, I understand that. So this is a bit of an idealistic wish list. But I think that shelters that are fostering animals who've been exposed to violence, they need to have a behaviourist on hand who understands how the animal's behaviour is linked to that trauma and how to intervene in ways to stop it, or at least to make it more manageable.
That is a mandatory thing for us. Because our focus, I guess, is really narrow and it's solely on animals that have been affected by domestic violence, we identified really early on that we would need to be working with animal behaviouralists to be able to, you know, help those animals towards recovery of that trauma. So for us, that's absolutely mandatory and something that we will do.
Great, fantastic.
I'm thinking, Nick, that you're talking about something that we're really only just doing for people now, how it's mandatory for medical staff to talk about family violence or the recognition of abuse, and how long that took to come into play. It's going to be another mindset change for people in authority and opportunities to make changes to understand the importance of this before we see any signs. So again, my hope is that it comes quicker rather than being delayed because people don't understand. So again, opportunity to talk it is an opportunity to change it.
Yes.
Have you got any final points you'd like to raise that we haven't yet touched on?
My real thing that I talk about everywhere and every opportunity that I have is that I am thrilled to see all of these initiatives. I really am. And I'm thrilled to see the awareness. But what I think is missing from this, and not necessarily missing from today's guest, I think we all understand this, but missing from the larger picture, is an understanding that, yes, we need to help animals who are being abused in domestic violence situations because it helps humans, but we also need to help them because it helps them. They are also victims in and of their own right. And they can be victims in cases where humans are not. So I think that we need to look at this as interconnected, but we don't need to look at this as interconnected with the animals as somehow inferior or their experience as somehow less. I think their experience is equally as traumatic. And I think naming them as victims and trying to address any changes moving forward with them as seen as victims and ultimately as survivors is incredibly important here.
I think if there were a greater recognition of particularly pets but animals more broadly as being part of the family, I think that would be a really huge step towards that, Nick. I think if we started to position pets in that family situation more, I think that would be much more relatable for people.
I agree with that. I think that's key. But I also think key is a legal change. Julie touched on the idea earlier that animals are considered as property in most of protection laws, and in fact, in most people's minds. And I think that has to change. And this has to do with, you know, beliefs about their sentience, about their emotional capacities. As I said before, we haven't got much research into the emotional traumas that they suffer because a lot of people still argue they don't have sufficiently developed emotions to suffer trauma, which we all know is not the case. So I think we need to change our view of animals and of how they fit into our societies and our lives if we're actually going to get to the root of this problem rather than trying to take band-aids around the top of it.
Yeah, and I think I'm excited about the appointment of Marama Davidson around these issues, family violence and sexual violence. And I've heard that she's a big animal lover, so hopefully there may be some work that we can all do with government to raise this issue more as well.
I think if I would want to wrap up anything, it's that these kind of conversations are incredibly important in building relationships between all the connectors within a family violence situation. We've had the privilege of working locally with animal welfare workers from a variety of places, I guess locally, particularly the SPCA, and the support we've had, the quick response that we've had, the additional giving when they've understood the need has been significant. And for those of us who are predominantly working with the human beings and then realising that there's fur babies connected, we have to then journey that together. We can't put the pets to one side and the humans to another side. It comes together when they've been family. So as we've talked before, we do need to recognise that they come together. And so for as much as we look for support for adults and children, how are we doing that for pets? So I think relationships within organisations, bringing together these worlds that we're doing today, is an opportunity for there to be a change, both with those who hear the stories, but maybe with those that are finding themselves involved. I'd like to think that in the future, people would feel okay about needing to leave a situation because the pet will be cared for as much as I will be. We always look for opportunities to be able to connect with organisations that can help us support our families, whatever the need. So this has been great today. I've gone away with a whole lot of notes that I probably didn't expect to make sure that things are connected for those families that we work with that have got pets involved.
Echoing what you've said, the one thing I've noticed with some of the families and pets we have been able to help on occasion, the key thing for them is to know that the quality of care and the place that their pets are going to go to is really high. And so, you know, they're not just going to be shoved in a cage somewhere or locked up and not have exercise and all these things. So that care for the pet takes that stress away for them and gives them comfort knowing that they're going to be well looked after. So that's really, really important. And knowing that they can get their pet back, not having to surrender them necessarily, and knowing that there's no financial burden and sort of no time limit really on how long a pet can be looked after while they secure their own safety is really important too.
I'm a bit of a nagger, and if it takes a few years for something to change or to be heard, I'm okay with that. I guess what I've learned is that I need to have the evidence, and sometimes it's about getting the right story and also the right ear to nag in. I guess my process normally is once I get a bee in my bonnet, I just keep bringing it up, and one day someone will hear something.
I mean, these things can be painfully slow. I may be being idealistic, which is not my default setting, but I do feel as though there's so much noise about this at the moment that people are interested, that now is the time to kind of strike.
It is. Yeah, absolutely.
I was listening to a webinar last night in Australia. I think it was New South Wales. There's so much of what we've talked about this morning that was said and talked about there. I can't get over the correlation today. And they're wanting the same change within legislation and the same trainings to be offered. So it's not foreign in the world. It's just about getting it in the right place, you know?
That seems like a great place to wrap up this kōrero. Kia ora, thank you all so much for this discussion today. When I was looking up some information for this topic, I thought, goodness me, it's not something I knew much about, but wow, how depressing and how traumatic. But I think it is good that we're talking about these sorts of things. Hopefully, then more people will gain some awareness and some change will start to take place.
Kia ora.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And great to meet everyone on the call, and love to talk further with you about how we can work together as well.
Yeah, same. Fantastic that we're all so interested.
pocket. Some are in a locket. He couldn't bring himself to waste them. Ever since she's gone, some days he can't go on. She ruined him for another. Pressed up against the glass, he prays that she will pass. Now he's living with his mother. Lily comes when you stop to